This is the Kestrel Country Podcast, where we discuss the people, places, and events all around Kestrel Country. Well, Don Morse, Jed, thanks for jumping on the podcast today.
Sure thing.
Good spring day. We were just talking about it before it started, but the day after turkey season ended. So
they're talking.
We'll talk a little bit about turkeys. But I thought it's helpful just to get a little bit of background. We know kind of Jed's background, but Don, where did you grow up? How did you get into the outdoors, and what brought you to Moscow?
So we grew up over on the west side of Washington State, and early years were in the South Seattle area, and then later on out in Gig Harbor, Washington, and that's where I went to high school. And that's also where I got into hunting. So I worked at a Christian camp and earned enough money in the summer washing dishes to buy a Model 94 3030, one box of shells, Washington State license, and a tag. And my dad and I shared that gun, and we hunted the tree farms near our house. And we got out one day probably November during the blacktail rut, and I took my first deer with that 94. And it was crazy because we didn't have a hunting knife in the house. No Gore-Tex.
So you were the first one of your family to get into it.
No Gore-Tex. I'd saved 8 bread bags and used them for boot liners to keep the feed dry.
Wow.
And we didn't even have a hunting knife. And Dad had his survival knife from his Marine Corps flight gear, and we used that to dress that deer up. And again, no YouTube, you know. And I remember seeing pictures in Outdoor Life of, you know, taking care of a deer. We took care of it, and then we had a 1.5-mile hike out to get the deer back to the 63 Pontiac station wagon. Well, we didn't know how to drag a deer, right? And so we came up with this idea of falling a 20-foot Doug fir, limbing it, and then trussing the deer
hanging that thing on there.
on that Doug fir. You know, we'd see pictures of the pilgrims, you know, hiking out with their deer.
That must be efficient.
Well, the pilgrims had the sense to use an old dead tree. This thing was flexible, you know, and it weighed probably half as much as that deer. And so we're hiking out, and every step we took, the deer would bounce, you know, and it took 3 weeks for our shoulders to recover from hauling that deer out. So that was the first time.
That was the first. Now, do you still have that rifle?
You know, I had to sell it for books for college. Yeah. I wish I did.
Oh, man, that's a pretty good start. I don't know. That's probably the best way to start.
Yeah. You were hooked.
Low expectations, you know. It's just all uphill from there.
Oh, yeah. And then Lisa and I met at WSU in the 80s. I actually came to WSU to hunt chukar, and the degree was ancillary. And the only gun I had to hunt those chukar was a little H&R 20-gauge single shot, but the extractor was broken. So I had to carry a piece of doweling to knock the spent shells out. And I will never forget, you used to be able to hunt the breaks down by Wawai. And I showed up down at Wawai, I got out with this H&R and my piece of doweling, and two other guys, well-heeled hunters, are pulling out their over-unders and their short hair pointers. And I heard one of them look over and say, "The kid's got a muzzle loader." And so that's, you know, that was how I hunted the chukar down in the breaks of the snake. And
no dog, just
no dog, you know, but I fell in love with this area and dreamed of coming back here. And so 97, we actually made the break from the west side and came out. It's the hunting over here is just remarkable. I pinch myself every time I get out in the timber. When we hunted, first bow hunted in 87 in the Cascades, A friend and I bumped into a party of two other hunters, and that was 1987. By 1997, in that same area, we counted 20 elk camps. And if you if you just, you know, assume four hunters per camp, per RV, wall tent, or whatever, that's 80 hunters. So we went from four to 80 hunters in a 10-year period. Yeah. And so we get out over here, Mike. I mean, we may not see anyone all day.
Hey, who's parked at that gate back there?
Yeah, right, yeah.
That's not where I'm going, but what are they doing out here?
Yeah, right. So it's just remarkable. I mean,
Well, on maybe to that point, how have you seen it change a lot in your since 1997 being here?
Around COVID. So I will never forget heading out to some of the honey holes that I hunt the turkey in, and there were RVs parked where there'd never been RVs before, and so it was right around 2020, I think, that that things changed, at least during the turkey season.
People didn't have to go to work. Kids are out of school. Well, I remember fishing. I think me and you went fishing once.
Yeah,
it was a weekday.
Yeah.
Like, well, how are this many people out? Yeah. It's like kids and their parents because school was canceled. And parents didn't have to go
to work. Well, Washington was being crazy with actually not even allowing you to get out and hunt.
Well, and there were Washington plates on the RVs.
Yeah.
And sadly, they still are.
So you're still seeing a lot of... You think some of those people who came are coming back?
I know they are. I know they are. And you know, I understand that. I mean, if you love the outdoors, if you love to hunt and fish, there is something very unique about the Panhandle. I mean, very, very unique. So I get it. I wish it wasn't happening, but I get it.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those, you know, you want to be out there and you love the access. Like that's the big struggle, right? Like public land is awesome and the accessibility and we want to take advantage of it. But there's always a little bit of like, well, now that I'm using it, I don't want some other guy.
Right. Yeah.
So 97, you've been here for a while. And what were you doing before you were doing calls and lures and
so,
all that stuff?
So I worked for Microsoft for about 28 years. And in July of 2014, they laid off 19,000 of us. And I've always loved technology, and I've loved the outdoors. And it occurred to me that maybe we could tinker with 3D printers and make outdoor products. And so the first product we created was a fishing lure. And then maybe 4 or 5 years after that, I decided to take a stab at the turkey call.
Yeah. So tell us about the lure. How did that? I know, Jay, you were doing some tying, and you guys have tested them out. I've seen some of those.
Oh videos. Yeah.
So how did you get into that? Is that something from back in your time on the West Side?
Yeah. Well, I fished the salmon on the West Side, but we fished with herring, and I wanted to experiment and see if we could create a lure that would trigger the fish. And game fish have what's called a lateral line that runs the length of their body. It's an exposed nerve, and they pick up on vibrations. And so what I was attempting to do was to create something that vibrated at a frequency that it would actually attract the fish from the vibration before there was any visual contact. And so it took hours of experimenting. I'd print maybe a half dozen prototypes, and I'd hike out to the livestock trough at our barn and test them. And I think my wife was thankful we were so far from any neighbor, you know. And so after I'd tested maybe 36, 48 different lures, I might have two or three that looked fishable. And so I'd take the drift boat out to Rock Lake and pull them behind the drift boat. And we hit a design that really did seem to trigger those fish. And that was the OG-1. That was our first lure model. And I tried that same model for the steelhead down in the Clearwater, and it wasn't getting a response.
Interesting.
And I believe it's because the action was just too erratic for those fish. And so I modified the design so that the action was not quite as erratic.
More streamlined, overall.
A little more stable, right. And then started fishing that for the salmon out in Puget Sound and up at CQ. And we've had some pretty remarkable results, including a 30-pound king by this guy here.
That was a fun day. Yeah, that was pretty cool to build the lure in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Catch that type of fish on.
Yeah, yeah, that's amazing. I mean, like, the only thing I've ever had that's even close to that is, like, tying a fly. Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Tie a fly, and then you catch a fish with it. You're like, wow, this is really...
Yeah,
really neat.
Feel like you're, yeah.
But to catch a 30-pound salmon, that's amazing.
And I used to tie flies, Mike. And I think you've probably tinkered with, well, what would happen if instead of silver tinsel, I put some gold tinsel on this fly? Or what would happen if, you know, instead of a red thorax, you know, we tried a red and a purple thorax or whatever. And it's those subtle experiments. When they work, boy, it's fun. Because you've customized that fly. And gotten that response. And so it's been a similar deal with the lure gig. We've got folks from Alaska down to California fishing these things now. And it's been a lot of fun.
So OG, old goat.
Old goat. Right.
Where'd you get that name? Where'd that come from?
We were kicking names around. And I'd thrown out some names. Old goat was one of them. And a family member said, oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's it. I like it. Yeah.
So, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So how long ago, when was that trip that you guys took out there? Was that CQ?
That was CQ. We did a couple.
We've been a few times.
Yeah.
Yep. Man, I can't remember when we caught that really big one. Was
that 2021?
Yeah. 2020 or
2020? 2020, I think, because you and Cotton came 2021.
Okay.
When we hit that storm.
Okay.
And
That sounds right. Yeah. Yeah, I puked off the boat a couple times.
Man. Oh, hey. We got caught, and I'm going to guess there were 11-foot standing waves. Ooh. And we were 2 or 3 miles out. And that was one for the books.
That's an adventure.
Yeah.
Wow, man. Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. So the lure's going well. Do you sell them online? Is it retail?
Right. We sell them through the website.
Okay.
We've had a couple of shops contact us to see if we'd go wholesale, but our volume is limited, and so we haven't gone retail yet. But it's working online.
That's great. So it seems like a pretty big jump from fishing lures to turkey calls.
How did that happen? I've always loved any sort of calling, you know, whether it's predator calls, whether it's bugling in the elk, calling ducks, geese, or whatnot. And it occurred to me when I started tinkering with the turkey call, and particularly with the pot call, that all of the pot calls that had been designed had been designed with holes in the bottom. Mm-hmm. And you're basically kicking the sound into a gloved hand, and that dampens the sound. And I thought, you know, what would happen if we actually added a sound port that would project the call out to the bird that we're working.
Interesting.
And so I started tinkering with the calls. And I found a piece of software that lets me digitize the waveform of the call. And then I can compare that waveform to the sound of the National Wild Turkey Federation has, you know, live recordings out there. And so I could capture the waveform of the actual hen yelping or cutting or purring and compare that sound to the waveform generated by different surfaces. So we've got... an aluminum surface, a ceramic surface. I've experimented with different slate surfaces, and all of the different surfaces elicited a different sound. And so it's just been a matter of experimentation and then hitting the field, you know, and which is the part I love.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, so you've been turkey hunting for a long time.
For probably 20 years.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And had you been thinking about making your own calls way back then?
No.
And
no.
It was just, it was
once you figured out the ability of the printer.
Right. And so after tinkering with the 3D printer, and I really think you guys need a 3D printer in your house. There is something about this device where if you can conceptualize a part, you can literally have it sitting next to you in, you know, depending on the complexity, 20 minutes to an hour. So just yesterday, I'm laying out the irrigation line for our vegetable garden, and I wasn't able to find a coupling that would let me connect the drip line to the main line. And I was able to 3D print couplings that, you know, we could just pop in there. And it's problems like that, you know, where I think these devices are just crazy fun.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have to experiment a lot with the type of plastic that you're using to print it? I would imagine with lures especially.
Yeah. You do. So one of the common plastics that folks use when they start printing is polylactic acid, and it's a plant-based plastic, and so it's safe, no toxic fumes or whatnot, but it has a fairly low melting point. And so if you were to use that for lures, if a guy put his tackle box in the window of his truck, you know, they'd be melted or distorted, right? And so it took time to experiment with different plastics. One of the first plastics we experimented with was ABS, which is a very strong plastic, but the fumes are toxic, and Lisa told me no more. So,
on the house at least. Huh?
Yeah. So yeah, and every plastic has different temperature constraints in terms of, you know, at what point it adheres and melts and so on. Every printer has different characteristics, and so there's a lot of experimentation. And the printers I'm using are hobbyist printers, Mike. And they're not made to run, 12 hours a day. So I'm, as Jed knows, I'm constantly repairing printers. I don't know how many times we'd have a lure handoff planned, and I'd shoot Jed an email, Jed, the printer's broken again, you know. And so there's quite a bit of work to keep the printers running.
Are you going out of stock on, you know, lures and stuff then fairly regularly?
It has happened. January, we were surprised. We got hammered with sales, which we didn't expect. And they were salmon lures, of all things. And then last September, again, we had a huge spike in sales. And that was a byproduct. Northwest Fishing Reports came up to CQ and fished with us. And they did a TV show. And when the show hit Portland and Seattle and
you can
Spokane.
See the direct.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah.
So what about the lure? Now, Jed, have you been using these in the woods?
Yeah, we were just talking about that. I haven't made it out enough. I took that black aluminum out. I made it out twice this year. Both times, I mean, we had turkeys fired up, you know, multiple turkeys both times. We just, it was more of a human error than a call error. Call error.
Well, that's a huge
can't
part
blame
of
on
it.
The call. Yeah. No, like, you know, one, we got in real close on, but we were kind of in the reprod.
Yeah.
And he was just strutting on the end of this logging road up in a slashed out cut. He was wide open.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's just waiting for us to come up to him.
Right.
So, you know, he's, every time we hit the call, he's, you know, he's fired up, just waiting.
Right.
After like 20 minutes, though, you could tell he's kind of like, why aren't they coming? I'm waiting. I'm looking. You know, we're down there like, he's going to see us.
he wants to see the hen. You know, and I've started carrying decoys because – It seems like if they hear that hen, they want to see it, and if you can strategically put a deke out in front of the shooter, it changes things.
Yeah, I think it's just I love being active.
Oh, I do too.
I think a lot of the turkeys around here, you have to be. You know, we're not sitting on food plots.
Yeah,
back east where you set up your decoys and get in the edge of the field. Sit and call for a couple hours. You know, you really have to locate them.
Yeah.
Cut the distance, you know, which we've done good, but then he's like, well, they're cutting the distance.
Right.
Well, and it was just so thick.
Yeah.
You know, if you can cut the distance and then find a spot, you know,
right.
Set up, get the decoy out and bring them just a little bit, kind of like elk hunting.
Yeah.
Bring them just a little bit. Get them to come in a little.
You got to get in their back door. Yeah. And once you're in the, you know, the back
yeah.
door. The other thing that was interesting last year is the ceramic call actually pulled in a bear. And pulled in two bear. The first time I was up on Bennett ground with a friend, and we had a sow and a cub come in. And then I'd lost my GoPro, gone up looking for the GoPro, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to hit fighting purrs as I go in.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
Oh, that's awesome.
That sounds good.
And so I'm just hitting fighting purrs. And
as you're kind of walking in.
As I'm walking in, and... there were some morels on the trail, so I, you know, grabbed them, put them in my vest, headed up the trail, and I looked, and there's a bear staring straight at me 30 yards away. And wow. And I thought, I'll bet it's that sow again, because I'm in the same general area, and we can only take the boar, you know. And so I'm just standing there, I got the Benelli up, and the wind is blowing from my right, and it's just... It's just sitting there looking at me, and I keep listening for the cub, thinking that a cub's got to be around, and then the wind shifted and came from behind and blew my scent right to him. I thought he's out of here, and no, it just stayed right there, and I thought, oh,
he doesn't care.
Yeah, right. And I'm still thinking it's got to be that sow. But it wasn't. It was a lone boar, and he'd been up on a stump, and he climbed down off that stump, and he just slowly ambled out. If I'd had a rifle, I would have had just a beautiful quartering shot on him. And so I went in the next day with my out six, and I thought I'm going to get this guy. And same deal, fighting purrs. And I pull in a flock of turkeys.
And you had your out six.
My out six.
No shotgun. Oh man.
Yeah, is that so? They're coming in to the turkey call,
right?
Looking for an easy meal, kind of idea, or are they just curious?
Yeah, it occurred to me with the bear, if they've been around the block, when those turkey are fighting, A, they're distracted, and B, there's more than one, right? And so. Where that bear's a hunter, it may be conditioned to be attracted to that, that fighting purr.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how long have you been making these then?
Oh, Mike, I think it's been 3 years.
And are they on your website too? Or not yet?
Well, they were, and then I felt like we were close. But I didn't know if we were there in terms of having the optimal sound. And we hadn't done the aluminum surface until this year.
Yeah, let's hear that one. Some purrs on that, because that's my favorite. I like that one.
And so we pulled it off the website to answer your question. And I'm just debating whether to go live with it.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Sounds really good.
So that's the purrs, the cuts. And I actually had a hen and I were doing this for 15 minutes about 2 weeks ago. and then the yelps. You can kind of hear the raspiness in there. And it seems like that raspiness is part of what really gets them going.
And is that partly the aluminum versus the ceramic that gives it a little bit of rasp?
The ceramic has a higher pitch.
Okay.
A little higher pitch.
Oh, yeah.
So is anybody else doing aluminum?
Yeah.
Because typically you see the frosted glass.
Slate is probably the most common.
Yeah, okay.
And there are, I think, three or four different types of slate that come from the East Coast. And then you've got the ceramic, crystal, the glass, and the aluminum. And what I've discovered, at least with our body design, is that the glass and the crystal really don't elicit that the quality of sound that we get from the aluminum and the ceramic. Hmm. So these are the two that I've really focused on.
And people refer to them as slate calls.
Right.
So that was the original.
That was the original
surface.
That was the original.
And then our pot call.
Pot calls.
Yeah. Was that because of just the shape of it, or did they originally have built them with a clay pot kind of deal?
No. So just because of the cylindrical shape, the first pot calls were created on a wood lathe, and so guys would they'd turn different hardwoods on that lathe. I think one of the most effective high end woods is a cherry wood, and there's something about the way that wood resonates combined with that friction surface. It just gives you a unique sound. And then because they're creating them on a lathe, old tech, that is why the holes were drilled in the bottom, but there usually weren't cuts in the perimeter. And that's the one advantage of that 3D printer, is you can experiment with the sorts of perimeter cuts or openings or whatnot that the guys would need some more expensive equipment to create if they were doing this with wood. Hmm.
What are the limits to a 3D printer, though? Is it production? Is it
how? It's production. So typically, folks will prototype with a 3D printer, and then they'll injection mold.
Sorry, go ahead.
You're good.
Injection mold.
So they'll go to injection molding after they've 3D printed the parts. And injection molding brings its own set of complexities. So, for example, with that perimeter cut, and with the call itself, you have to design the body. You'd have to change the design a little bit so that the parts of the mold can easily slip in and out.
It's usually a two-part with the injection mold.
Yeah.
The two sides.
Yeah.
You put them like a fishing lure where they do the two
right,
sides.
Right. So time is really the limiting factor with the 3D printer.
Yeah. Is that, do you have, now that you're honing in on that, you think you're going to put them back up and have them for sale?
That's a great question. I almost think that the turkey call will probably be something that we will want to injection mold, just because of the amount of time it takes to create each call.
Amount of plastic with the sound.
Yeah.
Is that something that, when you talk about injection molding, do you have to get that done somewhere else, or is that something you can do yourself too?
No. Injection molding is a different beast. Huge machines.
Okay, and so that's like sending it out. You get your design all figured out, and then send it off and
make a bulk order.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So and you pay. I think a minimal cost for an injection mold would be about $20,000. So you have to know that you're going to sell a lot of whatever, to make that pencil out. But there's a company up in Spokane that injection molds the handles for buck knives. And actually went up and talked to them when I first started working on the lures. I was thinking about injection molding the lures, and it just didn't pencil out given our production. Down the road it might, but right now it just doesn't.
Yeah. So you can keep up with it on the
printer,
on the lures.
Yeah.
But not maybe as much on something bigger, more complex like that.
On the call. Right now, we've got three running printers at the house. Our ideal would be to have five or six, and three of them are down, and I'm ordering parts, working, trying to get them back up. But the ideal would be to have five or six printers running, 12 hours. A typical, for example, for the large salmon lures, on one large bed printer, if I'm printing 14 lures, that's a 17-hour print. So I'll start it in the morning, and next morning I'll grab those 14 lures. With the smaller lures, with our smallest salmon lure, I can print 55 in 12 hours. So depending on the lure size, the amount of plastic that we're using, you know, you've got different efficiencies there.
Are you able to, like, the turkey calls and the lures, are you having to reposition those at all? Or can you push the button and it'll start to finish? You don't have to be there.
That's a great question. So initially you'll experiment, you know, how can we optimize that print bed to get as many lures of this size or as many calls of this size on it? And once we've done that, then it is really a push button thing. Okay. The problem is, you know, every third day, one of the prints will fail. So one of the lures will back off the print bed.
Okay.
And then everything gets tangled up. So you're going in periodically through the day. Right.
Well, that really gives some context to the cost and everything. You know, like that's a lot. That's a lot of time, a lot of
it is
effort. And so like how long would it take to make one of these calls?
One call is probably going to be a 55 to 65 minute print. And the reason I say 55 to 65 is you can actually adjust the percentage of fill in whatever you're printing. So for example, if I just fill this, with a 55% fill, you know, we're probably at the low end. If I go to a higher 75% fill or 80% fill, then it does take more time.
And then you're coming in and gluing in this
gluing the surface on right
surface
right.
on yeah, afterwards. Yeah. So some hand
right
hand work as well.
Right, but it's really really minimal on the turkey call. On the fishing lures, we're painting scale patterns and different colors. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
And so it's
clear coating
and that's all done by hand after
that,
the print. That,
yeah. Made in America, man.
Wow.
All by hand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
What do those retail for on your website?
Boy, Lisa ballpark. Can give you the answer right now. Mike, I think our 2.8 inch salmon lure is in the 650, 675 range. The largest salmon lure, depending on the plastic and the color scheme, will run about $9.75, $10. And then on the freshwater lures, the small kokanee lures, which a lot of guys are fishing now, fish, I think they sell for about $4.75 a piece. But again,
that's pretty amazing for how much is going, how much time
well, for
and effort.
In America,
yeah.
Compared to your go to Walmart, you're going to spend that all day.
Right.
Yeah. So, have you done much of the kokanee fishing? You mentioned kokanee.
You know, I've tried kokanee fishing now and again. My love is the salmon fishing. That's my passion. That's my love. I enjoy fishing Rock Lake for the rainbows and the browns as well.
Okay.
But I haven't really gotten into the kokanee big time, but we've got some customers that are. And a number of them fish Lake Chelan, and then some fish Lake Roosevelt. And we happened to have caught a 22-inch kokanee out of Roosevelt 3 or 4 years ago when we were fishing the Bows, you know. So
that's pretty fun.
Well, that's yeah. That's a fun fish.
Have you done much of the kokanee fishing, Jen?
No, you know, we've caught some here. I think we caught one in Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I think, man, did we catch one in Rock Lake?
We did.
I think we did.
Yeah. They're not stocked in Rock.
No, I think I remember somebody saying, that's not a kokanee in Rock Lake. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure it is. That's look at the tail.
Yeah.
But, yeah, here and there, but we never, you know, I've always thought it would be fun to go to, like, the Lake Wallowa over there in Oregon.
Yeah,
you know, they've got, I think the Oregon record was out of there.
Well, it was a huge fish.
Yeah.
And I think that would have been, 2010, 20.
Okay. I remember seeing pictures of it. Someday.
That's a
we'll
fish.
We'll go down there
that's
catch some of those.
That's a fish. That's a fish.
Because there's a lot of guys that go to Dorshak, right? And catch all the small ones.
Yeah.
And eat them and that kind of thing. But you like going after the bigger fish.
There's something about being out on the salt. And I just, you know, last year I was out at Sea Key with a friend, We actually had a pod of dolphins come and play around the boat. And, you know, it's those kinds of experiences, the gray whales, the killer whales, the dolphins. And then, you know, if you top it off with a few fish, oh, it's fun.
That's awesome.
And we've got a couple of new colors. I found some plastic. One plastic has UV reflective particles embedded in the plastic, and another has UV glow particles embedded in the plastic. And we tested the UV reflective particles last year out of CQ, 1 week after they shut down the Kings.
Okay.
So it was only open for the Coho.
Yeah, that's when you catch the Kings.
8 Kings in 1 hour.
Wow.
In 1 hour.
Way.
Yeah,
no
off
way.
A slip point.
Wow.
Before the sun came up.
Wow.
And we've never had a morning like that. And wow. And so I want to find out this summer if that's just a one-off, you know, a freak incident, or if
you're gonna try to go when it's still open. For
yeah. Oh. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. And just see if that UV reflective color is as effective as it was that morning.
Hmm. So when is that? When's the prime time to get over there and fish?
I think Washington can change their salmon season on a whim, but I think Kings are slated to open July 1. And then they typically run through most of July. And then the Coho, the ocean Coho, will start coming in mid-August.
Okay.
And the big ocean Coho will come in early September. Every odd year, there's a run of pink salmon. And so this year, being an odd year, you'll have the Kings, the Pinks, and the Coho.
Wow.
The pink salmon tend to come in late July, I think, early August. Mm-hmm. So.
What about Rock Lake? When's the best time to fish? That's a little more accessible for most people.
Rock Lake is an incredible fishery. The boat launch is very primitive. You know, folks need to be aware of that. And and wind can be an issue on rock as well.
Mm.
And you do need to be careful about the wind. And you also need to be careful about the basalt columns. So if it's your first time on rock, go with someone, you know, else who's been there before, or stay in the middle of that lake, because guys have lost the lower unit on their motor, snagging one of those basalt columns.
Mm.
I think for the big brown trout, it's my understanding that late October, early November is probably the ideal time. For the bows, I think you can fish rock just about any time of the year and do pretty well on the bows. We were just out with Northwest Fishing Reports 2 weeks ago on rock to do a TV segment, and the water was very, very murky, but we still caught about 15 bows.
Fun. That's cool.
Wow.
And it was that perch, the green perch pattern.
Yep.
That we often start out, you know, if we're on Roosevelt or rock, we'll put the green perch on one rod, and it was very effective.
Hmm. So. That's awesome.
It's fun. Mike, we are so blessed to live where we live. You know, we're just blessed to live where we live.
So you love the salt. You love getting out there, but you don't regret. You'd still pick living here. It's close enough. You can still get over there.
Yeah. You know, because, just the hunting pressure and density over there is crazy. And the turkey hunting is nowhere close, except for up in northeastern Washington. There is not turkey hunting like there is here. The whitetail hunting, the elk hunting, and then with my wife, the grandkids. So I don't think we're moving.
There you go. Yeah, well, the variety of both terrain, species, all kinds of stuff around here, I think is one of the most unique things, you know?
Oh, it is.
You got canyons, you know, deep down into the Hell's Canyon. You got the rivers running down there with salmon and steelhead run even.
Yeah.
You got fly fishing up in the mountains. You got, you know, like you said, upland birds, chuckers, all that. And then big game. It's pretty crazy.
Oh, it is. It is. And I think if you move to Colorado, you might find the elk hunting on a per hunter basis, the harvest ratio is a little bit higher, but I don't think you would have, you know, the incredible whitetail hunting like we have here in the Panhandle. It's generally mule deer over there, you know, and same if you went down to Utah, you might find, you know, the muley hunting is exceptional or whatnot, but But there's a unique mix here in the Panhandle, you know, that...
You find yourself having a pick.
Oh, you do. Yeah.
Fall hits. It's like, oh, man.
Yeah, what am I
going to
do?
Where's time going?
Right.
Am I going to run a bear bait? Am I going to go hunting? Am I going to do archery? It's not like Utah where like, well, let's see if I'm able to hunt this year.
Right.
Put in for the elk tag and
I might not get it. Yeah,
you know, it's super accessible.
Yeah, Idaho does a good job managing for access.
They really do.
Yeah,
they really do.
Our opportunity is probably how they put it, right?
Yep. Managing for opportunity.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was the last year I bow hunted in Washington, 97, they had consolidated the archery elk season to, I think, a week. And it was actually outside of the rut. And you could only hunt spiking cows. You had to enter a lottery to get a mature bull permit, and so you enter a lottery for a hunt that quality wise doesn't come close to what we have over here.
Wow!
And that was just the nuts and bolts of that hunt versus the hunt over here.
Yeah. Good. Well, where's the best place for people to find? What's your website? The lures.
Oldgoatlures.com.
Okay.
And yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Don. Appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, guys.
Good talking to you.
Hey, enjoyed it.
Good luck out there fishing this year.
Thank you. If you guys, seriously, if you'd want to come.
it's too much fun.
We're going over, speaking of salt, I'm going over to San Juan's in another couple weeks.
So, are you?
Yeah, we're going to be out there just for family vacation. But
I don't know. Is that Marine Area 7, you know?
I don't know. I have to look it up. I haven't planned very well yet, so.
I think it's 7. I don't think the Kings open up until July 1. It used to be, when I was a kid, we could start fishing the Kings in June. And there's a winter king fishery. It's called the blackmouth fishery. And it used to be that blackmouth would open in November and run until February or March. This year, guys in the Puget Sound got 4 days. 4 days. Hmm. You know, and it used to be like 5 months. Hmm. So...
it's tough.
We need to deal with some sea lions.
Sorry.
There you go.
Oh, man.
All right. Thanks again.
Yeah.
Good talking.
Thanks for joining us. Like, share, subscribe. We'll see you next week.